Good day, and welcome to the U.S. Airways American Airlines Trial Conference Call. I'd like to turn the program over to our hosts.
Good afternoon, and thanks for joining the Capital Forum for today's conference call with Seth Bloom for a preview of the upcoming litigation between the Department of Justice and emerging U.S. Airways and American Airlines. I'm Teddy Downey, Executive Editor here at the Capital Forum, and I want to quickly introduce Joe Tipograph, who will in turn introduce Seth Bloom and lead today's interview. Joe is the lead antitrust correspondent for the Capital Forum and authored our initial report on the airlines, which was published on August 9, 2012, and was titled "Stakeholders Currently Underestimate Risk to U.S. Airways American Merger Approval at DOJ." Previously, Joe practiced antitrust law in Washington, D.C. for Hunton and Williams, and prior to that for Kelly, Dry, and Warren. He has represented clients on antitrust matters in litigation, government investigations, and mergers. He's also the proud holder of a BA in economics from the University of Michigan and a JD MBA from Emory. And with that, I'll turn things over to Joe.
Thank you, Teddy. And thank you all for joining on the Capital Forum's conference call on the upcoming U.S. Airways and American Airlines merger trial. I am Joe Tipograph, and we're delighted to have Seth Bloom here with us today. Now, we picked Seth because he is one of the best we could find for this topic, because he's one of the best out there for this topic. As a quick introduction, Seth is currently the president and founder of Bloom Strategic Counsel and is also on the American Antitrust Institute's advisory board. Now, prior to that, Seth spent nearly 14 years in the U.S. Senate on the Judiciary Committee's Antitrust Subcommittee, first as counsel for Senator Herb Kohl, and then as the general counsel for the subcommittee. Now, during his time there, he worked on all of the major airline mergers that came before the Senate, and at least four of them had very significant hearings that played a role in the outcomes. Now, prior to his work in the Senate, Mr. Bloom was a trial attorney in DOJ's antitrust division, where he exclusively worked on mergers during his time there. So he's very in touch with the nuts and bolts that goes into the analysis that DOJ applies to mergers. Like us, Seth was very adamant that the U.S. Airways American Airlines merger was not as much of a done deal as many had believed it to be, and he took the position that there was a lot of uncertainty and it was a highly discretionary call as to whether DOJ would let it go through. So he has been on point about this deal already, and his body of experience explains a big part of why. Before we get started, I just want to note a few quick things. I'll spend the first 30 minutes or so interviewing Seth, and then we'll turn it over to the audience for questions. If you have a question to ask Seth, please email editorial@thecapitalforum.com. And also, if you would like a recording of this call, please just let us know at the same email address. So with that, let's get started. Seth, thank you for joining us here.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation, and thank you for that very nice introduction.
You're welcome and welcome. Well, let's start off. We want to know, you know, what's going to be happening. So, you know, let's get right to it.
Okay.
What do you think the odds are of who is going to win at trial in the U.S. Airways, American Airlines versus DOJ merger case?
It's always dangerous to put odds on antitrust cases. I always say antitrust is an art, not a science. There's a tremendous amount of discretionary judgment. However, I think this is a very strong case that the Justice Department has brought. And if I was a gambling man, I would say the Justice Department would have about a 70% chance of prevailing. I take it as a 70-30 chance that DOJ will win this case at trial.
All right, and we are going to get into the art of science of that 70-30 call that you just made in a moment, but let's also think about all the other things that could happen here.
Sure.
All right, right now the trial is set for November 25th, and we're expecting to have a decision by mid-January. What are the chances that we don't follow that timeline, either because the case settles, or the parties abandon the transaction, or there are other reasons that this might get delayed and pushed back beyond?
Well, you've asked me a couple questions there. One gets into whether the case would settle before trial, and one is whether the case could possibly be abandoned by the merging parties. As to the question about whether it would settle, I think it's rather unlikely that this case settles. I mean, I don't think there's greater than a 10 or 20% chance that it settles. And here's why. If you read the complaint that the Justice Department has filed, it's quite a broad complaint. It alleges injury to competition in over 1,000 city pairs. It alleges that this merger will make it more likely that it'll be easier for there to be increased prices with respect to what they call ancillary fees, baggage fees, and change fees and the like. It's hard to imagine how a settlement could fix these problems when people were thinking that the case was just about Reagan National, and that's the way a lot of thinking was before DOJ filed the case. And by the way, it was an excellent report that you folks did to say that this case had a much greater risk than that. But when people were thinking about that, that was easy to settle. In fact, if that was all the case was about, it would have settled already. But the fact that the Justice Department issued such a broad complaint makes it hard to imagine how this case could settle. You know, you could think, well, the merging carriers, the New American, could sell off some airplanes to a competitor, to United, to a Delta, to another airline, to enter these markets and take care of the problem. But we're talking about airplanes here. These are movable assets. There's no way that the government could force whoever these airplanes were sold to fly on the routes that are of concern. The new airline, the airline they were sold to, could deploy them on its own routes. And there's no assurance that kind of divestiture would take care of the competitive problem here. In my mind, I just don't see a likely solution to the allegations raised by settlement, to the allegations raised in the Justice Department's case.
All right. Well,
you asked me about abandonment too, but
okay. Yeah. Why don't you touch on that?
So the other point is, is this thing likely to be abandoned before the trial? I think we're getting so close to the trial. I mean, it's barely more than 5 weeks away that it seems unlikely to me that the parties would abandon it. Obviously, from all the public statements of the U.S. Airways CEO, he really wants to get this deal done, and the U.S. Airways manager wants to get this deal done. In terms of the expense they've put into it, you got to think 75 to 80% of the expense has already been undertaken at this point. So, you know, having gone this far, it seems unlikely to me that they would abandon this case before November 25th. I don't know if there's going to be any new facts that are going to come out that are going to cause them to say, oh my God, you know, we're going to lose this case, so we would abandon it. Had the trial been in March, as the Justice Department was asking for, right after they filed the case, I think it would be very different. I think there would be a fair likelihood that the parties might have abandoned the deal before March. But now they've extended the time under which they could, the agreement for the merger, to mid-January, which is probably about the time the judge is likely to issue a decision here. So I think the prospects for abandonment are pretty remote at this stage.
Okay. All right. Now, what if all of a sudden the parties are willing to throw out the Reagan slots to at least fix that part of the complaint? Do you think that DOJ all of a sudden second guesses the rest of the complaint and maybe wants to settle because it doesn't have enough confidence that it can win the case without the Reagan argument in play? Or
I don't think so. I mean, I think those kinds of issues were settled before the filing of the complaint. If they didn't think they had good basis to file this complaint with the other allegations besides the slots at Reagan National, they wouldn't have filed it. They've accumulated all the evidence. They've done the economic analysis. They have the documents, which are very important. We can talk about that when we get into the merits discussion of this case. I don't think they're just going to abandon it because they can get a settlement on Reagan National. If you look at the complaint, that's about a quarter of the complaint, maybe less. The 69% that the airline would get after this merger is a substantial problem, but that's about a quarter of the complaint. So I don't think they're going to settle this case for getting relief on a quarter of what the allegations are.
All right. Well, for now, let's turn to the actual substance of the case. But for all of you who may have follow-up questions about settlement, again, we invite you to email your questions to editorial@thecapitalforum.com, and I'll be happy to turn to them at the end of this. But the real meat of the question is the merits of this case.
Sure.
And you're saying 70% chance for the government. Why don't you explain to us why you think that's the case?
And you'll have to excuse a little bit of a monologue at this point, because I think it's a strong case, and it takes me a little while to explain why, because I think there's a lot of reasons why. I mean, I think first you just look at the number of markets that the government is alleging will suffer what might be called a substantial injury to competition, which is over 1,000 markets, which go down from 4 to 3 competitors, and some of those go down from 3 to 2, and a few of those go down from 2 to 1. I just think the number of those markets, assuming the evidence supports what the government is saying in trial, is a very substantial injury to competition. So you look at that, number one. Number two, you look at the effect, what the government claims as the effect on ancillary fees, things such as baggage fees and change fees. I think this is a very interesting point. We saw in April, United Airlines, you know, raised in change fees from $150 to $200, which obviously is a pure expression of market power. I mean, there's no cost-based justification for that. So they raise the fees. What happens? Within 2 weeks, the other three remaining legacy or network carriers all raise the fees to change fees to $200. You know, it's clear it's easier for two other airlines to follow one than for three other airlines to follow one. So if you only have three players, all this kind of pricing becomes even more likely. And you know, right now, so these change fees are at $200. What's to say they wouldn't go to $300? I mean, nothing. And in fact, we would expect that they would. And this is sort of the theory of the government's complaint. If this merger went through, then likewise, you know, you could say the same thing with baggage fees, which I guess are about $35 for the first bag typically now. Why couldn't they go up to $50 or $60? I mean, this is a real competitive problem, especially given the history of the airline industry in extracting these kinds of fees. So I think that's another strong point in the government's complaint. And then I think that's bolstered by point number three, which are the documents that the government has, some very powerful documents of the intent of this merger. And, you know, and just on the point of ancillary fees, the airline said that they, one of the reasons they wanted to do this deal, or U.S. Airways, was because it would make it easier to raise these fees. And I'm pulling out a quote from the complaint. I'll come back to it later because I don't have it right in front of me. But so actually I did find it. There's a quote from an industry conference. Quote, consolidation has also allowed the industry to do things like ancillary revenues. This is a structural permanent change to the industry and one that's impossible to overstate the benefit from it. U.S. Airways CEO saying that fewer airlines is a good thing, and going back to fares, three successful fare increases we were able to pass along to consumers because of consolidation. That's a statement he made in 2011. So these are all statements from the past, but then when you get into the documents about why they did this merger, clearly those are the reasons why they did this merger. So I think those documents are very powerful documents. And then the final reason I think the government is a strong case is the issue of U.S. Airways advantage fares. So these are fares that for last-minute bookings that U.S. Airways prices substantially lower than the other legacy carriers, 30 to 40% lower. The concern here is that without U.S. Airways, once U.S. Airways and American merge, there wouldn't be the same economic imperatives for the new American to maintain these fees. So the market will lose the benefit of those fees. You know, we saw this important in the Justice Department's challenge of the AT&T T-Mobile merger when T-Mobile was considered to be the maverick. We saw this, the pricing maverick, disciplining fares. We saw this just last winter in the challenge in the beer merger, AB InBev and Grupo Modelo, where Grupo Modelo was acting as the maverick in refusing to go along with price increases that Anheuser-Busch and the others were going along with. Those were both cases the DOJ filed. In one case, the merger was abandoned. In another case, the merger was substantially restructured and the case was settled. So we haven't seen the sort of maverick theory tested in court, but I think it's a powerful theory. If you lose the maverick pricer, it's really a substantial injury to competition in the market. And so we run the risk, substantial risk, of losing that here. So there's another reason why I think it's a strong complaint. So, I mean, I think everything that I've talked about here has to be, these are all, I'm talking about what's in the complaint. It all has to be proven at court, and the government has the burden of proof. But again, assuming the government can prove these things in court, they've stated a very strong complaint, and that's why I think it favors them prevailing at trial.
Okay. All right. So we're thinking 70-30 in favor of the government. You've brought four points that we're going to just delve into a little bit here. One is the 1,000 markets that were pled. Two are the ancillary fees that were discussed. Three was the documents showing the intent of the merger. Four was the advantage fares argument. Let's start with one, the 1,000 markets.
Right.
Now, you know, I completely agree with you. This is a very large number of relevant markets. You don't see this in other mergers. Here in the United States, there's, 300 to 400 MSAs, so
right.
There's very rarely going to be something over 1,000 relevant markets.
Right.
It's the fact that you've got two airports, you know, combining to form a city pair that allows there to be a relevant market. But there's also an element to that that makes it more susceptible to challenge. In fact, these 1,000 relevant markets are less than 100 cities.
Okay.
All right? And, you know, in one report what we talked about was right now you've got flights from Hawaii to Indy, flights to Hawaii from Hawaii to Tampa, and many other cities from Hawaii to that are implicated by the merger, right? Now, Southwest currently doesn't fly from Hawaii to Indy. They don't fly from Hawaii to Tampa, but they fly from Las Vegas to those cities.
Right.
And we've seen evidence that Southwest is going to possibly include some overseas flights from Hawaii to to mainland United States. So if you just throw a flight from Hawaii to Las Vegas and you're Southwest Airlines, you don't just enter that one market, that one route. This is about direct and connecting flights.
That's right.
You've just entered several markets with just one flight. So, you know, the 1,000 markets, isn't it a little bit overstated?
Well, I mean, I think you brought up a lot of points there. First of all, I mean, I think the strongest defense I think the airlines have is the failure to include Southwest in these market calculations and just basically ruling Southwest out of the markets. And there's several ways we can think that Southwest should not be ruled out of the market. One of the ways is what you just described. Now, I guess so if Southwest starts flying into the United States, then you can build a connection, assuming there's a Southwest connection from that other city, Indianapolis or Tampa or whatever you mentioned, into the city where they're flying into Hawaii. I think you have to look at, but having said that, sure, they could, but you have, you know, the it's really an entry question. Will entry be timely, likely, and sufficient here? That's the test under the antitrust law. I mean, you can sort of create, and you know, in Hawaii is sort of an easy example because it's Hawaii. I mean, it's so valuable for leisure travelers. It's foreseeable that Southwest would want to enter that market, and I saw a report that they're buying new planes that are capable of flying over water for long distance. Okay, that makes sense. But so maybe they could do that with respect to that Hawaii market and all the connections into there. But, you know, we're talking about 1,000 city pairs. I mean, you can cherry-pick, I don't know how many, you know, you can cherry-pick 10 or 20 or even 100. But still, for them to take care of the competitive injury in a significant number of city pairs, I mean, I don't think they have the fleet to do it. I mean, how many planes does Southwest have? It's certainly not 1,000 planes.
A little under 700.
So, for them to redeploy their planes or even to allocate new planes they've ordered to these markets seems to be unlikely because they still want to fly the routes that they've been flying and flying profitably for so many years. So they're not just going to abandon their own routes. So you have to think of this as a change. And again, with an injury alleged this comprehensive, so national in scope, I just don't think even Southwest could go to enough places. Again, you identified one, which is an attractive one, but could go to enough places to take care of the competitive injury here. And then, you know, no airline is as large as Southwest. Even a JetBlue or Virgin America or Frontier, their fleets are even so much smaller than that. But I do think that Southwest is the strongest argument that the defense has. And if the defense can convince the judge that the Justice Department committed a fundamental error in not including Southwest, either in its current market analysis or the likelihood of entry of Southwest, just discounting that, that could be a reason why they could win the case. So it's hard to make a prediction. I think, from looking at it myself, the better argument is that it's not going to be enough. But I can't exclude the possibility that certainly will be a key for the defense if they have any hopes here, is to make Southwest part of all these markets or as many markets as they can.
Okay, so you know when you're talking about the 30%,
That's a big part. I would say it's about 25% of the 30. I mean, and one other point I wanted to make about Southwest, I think, this probably doesn't apply to Hawaii, but it applies to a lot of other places. You know, I think there's a strong argument that with respect to business travelers, Southwest really is not in the marketplace, even if they wanted to enter, because they don't have the premium seating. Passengers have to line up to get their seats. They don't have the breadth of the route structure. They don't have the international route structure. And also, finally, that makes their frequent flyer program less valuable, which business travelers really like to accumulate miles on frequent flyer programs. They don't have corporate rates to the same extent that, you know, the legacy carriers do. It's really, you can make a strong argument that Southwest is a different product, and it doesn't really participate in the business travel market. If that's true, and if business traveler is considered to be a cognizable submarket, I mean, it's enough to block this merger for there to be an injury to competition in the business traveler market. That is, business travelers would not, in response from a 5 to 10% price increase from one of the legacy carriers, switch their flying to Southwest. That makes business travel a separate product market. And, you know, Section 7 of the Clayton Act says a substantial injury to competition in any line of commerce in any section of the country is enough to make a merger illegal. So that would be a line of commerce. So I think that's another good reason why the Southwest is a strong argument that Southwest is properly not considered part of this market analysis with respect to business trends.
Okay. And so that actually, while I go into your second point, which is the ancillary fees,
right.
and I tend to agree with you, the Southwest is the biggest, you know, the threat of Southwest is probably the biggest weakness in the airlines mm-hmm. case as well.
In the government case.
In the government's case against the airlines.
Right.
Thank you.
Right.
That,
sure.
I think that what's nice in, that you bring up the ancillary fees is you do see United raising their fees, $150. All the others follow from 150 to 200
right.
2 weeks later.
Right.
You don't see Southwest doing it, and you don't see that
right.
stopping the carriers
right.
from keeping that price increase in place. So in other words, put differently, Southwest isn't participating in the price increases, and the other airlines don't necessarily seem to care, where the documents seem to show that they do care whether the other legacy carriers are going to be
right.
following.
Which is strong support for the idea that these other carriers really aren't part of the same market because they're not constraining price increases for the ancillary fees. Absolutely true.
And equally, I think that the ancillary fees is a very strong argument that the government makes. I don't have any specific questions to challenge that point, but I invite anybody from the audience who thinks they might to send them to editorial@thecapitalforum.com. So, but with that, I'm going to move on to... I'm going to skip question three for the moment and go to question four,
sure.
Point four, which is advantage fares
right.
and the Maverick theory.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I read the complaint. I see it. Yeah, sure, it's sexy. You saw the little Google ITA screenshots with U.S.
Right.
Airways last-minute flights being half the price of
right.
the legacy carriers. But, look, who are the last-minute fare buyers, first of all? Those are your business travelers who can afford to pay that kind of money and are happy to pay that kind of money. What's also happening with advantage fares, which we've learned and we've talked about in some of our reports here at the Capital Forum, is that U.S. Airways, in order to provide these fares, are keeping these flights or pricing flights off of the market
mm-hmm.
for advanced purchasers. Okay. So, you know, the kids who want to go visit their grandma and you know, everyday leisure travelers,
sure.
they're not getting these flights because they're being held back
okay.
so that U.S. Airways can sell them
right.
for cheaper to the last-minute flyers,
right.
the less price-sensitive flyers. So, I mean, do you think this is a flaw in the government's case, and how important is the advantage fares argument?
I mean, I think you just identified what could be a flaw. I mean, that's an important fact. This is good, but what you asserted is that they're holding stuff back, and what the government asserts is that consumers benefit, you know, by hundreds of millions or billions or whatever the number they use, by the presence of these fares. This is very much going to be tested at trial with evidence, with economic evidence. And I think we can't really say today which is going to prevail. So if, in fact, the airlines show that it's more beneficial for consumers to have full access to two-week-in-advance flights and U.S. Airways, by having these advantage fares, is really not allowing that, sure, that could defeat the argument on that point. But I think it's too, we just don't have access to the evidence to know which way that's going to go. So also, you have to think about these advantage fares constraining, that what you say is true, but still these advantage fares in some respect constrain the legacy carriers from raising fares, even if it's only a small portion. And so that might have a beneficial effect that wouldn't be present if the advantage fares weren't there. Having said that, I mean, I don't think that advantage fare argument is essential to the government to win the case, because I think it wins it on its... if it can prove its 1,000 markets, affect over 1,000 markets, and its ancillary fee arguments, and the documents that reflect that. So you don't absolutely need that. I think that's sort of like icing on the cake for the
okay.
government, but that's how I look at that.
Okay. I think that point's well taken. And let's go to the third point real quick before we get into the other arguments that the airlines are making here and why they may or may not
right.
work. That's the documents
sure.
that show the intent of this merger.
Right.
Now, you know, the lawyers who represent the parties that are involved in mergers, especially the ones who get sued, will always tell you don't pay attention to the documents. The DOJ maybe is cherry-picking these documents, that they're using them, they're placing them out of context. You know, you've worked at DOJ, you've worked on the Hill, you've kind of followed
sure.
the agency for a long time.
Sure.
I mean, to me, I'll be the first one to admit, when I got the complaint, I was in the car and had my wife just read me the quotes from the
right.
From the executives to really try to understand what the story was going to be, because that's how
right.
at least I understand what the government's theory is coming from. But, you know, how much weight are we supposed to give these documents when we think about this and trying to put these into context?
Right. Well, I mean, I think, again, you asked me a couple of different questions. I mean, in terms of the Justice Department's decision to file a case, I think documents like that are very important. And they are persuasive with the antitrust regulators about whether, because they want to know, you know, why these companies decided to do what they did and what the likely effects are, and, you know, as predicted by the companies. But, you know, now what's important is, what's the judge going to think about it? DOJ's filed the case. And that's the hardest question to answer. I will say this. Well, a couple things. First of all, you know, we think about it, antitrust as a very intellectual and sort of academic discipline. But, you know, judges are human beings, and they're not antitrust practitioners or antitrust academics, you know, writing law review articles about the developments of the doctrine in light of the Chicago School. I mean, they're human beings. And I believe that this kind of document can be very persuasive with a fact finder, which in this case is the judge. So I would not discount it. I think it's important. That's point number one. Point number two is that, you know, antitrust is a predictive discipline. We have to decide what's the likely effect going to be of this merger should it go through. And there are several ways to do it. You can look about what the likely effects were of past mergers in similar markets. That's one way to do it. But and you can also do sort of econometric projections. But another way to do it is to think about what the executives behind the merger thought would be the likely effect. And so it isn't even so much a matter of intent. It's like, what do we think will result from this merger? What we think will result from this merger is that fares will be higher. That's what they said. That's pretty powerful evidence. So now you're going to tell me that what you thought before the merger isn't true, and you've had a change of heart, and there's nothing more competitive than the airline industry, and competition's a great thing. I mean, I think it's belied by what you wrote, Mr. CEO, you know, a couple of years ago, and more recently than that, or what you said at conferences. So I do think, and you know, people can disagree, but I do think documents like this make a lot of difference. And I know, going back to the time that I was at the antitrust division, that was the opinion of the attorneys in the antitrust division, you know, who were trying these cases, is that, you know, that was probably the most important thing, was what the company's documents were saying. So I do that. That's why I count them seriously, and I know that the lawyers, you know, the day after this case was filed, said, oh, these documents, these quotes are taken out of context, and they're not that important. I mean, it's hard to say these kind of quotes are, you know, fewer airlines is a good thing. I don't know how you take that out of context. That's what these executives think. So, and I'm from the top ranks of U.S. Airways. So I do think they're important.
Okay. And does that sort of shape how we should be thinking about handicapping these trials? Because both sides are going to put on their economic evidence, and they're both going to say opposite things.
That's right.
Both going to say whatever supports their arguments. But at the end of the day, there are these documents here, and there's a lot of them. Right. I mean, this is a 57-page complaint, which is locked and loaded with these quotes.
Right.
Is this kind of where it all shakes
I think
out?
Like in an opening statement by the Justice Department, you know, they're gonna rely on it. And I think they're going to try to introduce these things into evidence, or they're going to cross-examine the senior executives of the airlines and say, what did you mean by this, and why did you say that? So, yeah, I mean, obviously the government is going to place a lot of emphasis on this. The defense is going to say it doesn't matter, and our economic analysis shows that this merger isn't so bad. In fact, it's better for consumers than if it didn't happen. So the defense is going to downplay it, and the prosecution, the government is going to raise up the level of importance. So, again, we'll have to see how the judge feels. I mean, again, this is something that's really hard to predict, because it very much depends on the decision-making process of one federal judge who, you know, rarely hears an antitrust case. Notably, she did hear the settlement of the Microsoft case about a dozen years ago, but she rarely hears an antitrust case. So it's hard to predict. We don't have a great body of evidence to know how swayed she'll be by documents like this.
All right. Well, what do we know, the judge, and what... When you say 30% of the case is to the parties, if you're predicting 30% chance for the parties, and 25% of that 30% is because of the argument surrounding Southwest, you know, what is the other 5%?
Well, I mean, I think it's intangibles, like the judge. It may turn out the judge is not sympathetic to antitrust enforcement or to this complaint or to the kind of evidence the Justice Department is introducing, such as these documents. We just don't know. Because all of it, it's very much a discretionary judgment in the hands of one person who, as I say, doesn't have much of a record on antitrust. She does have one prominent case, but that wasn't a merger case. I think there's a great element of uncertainty Now, I think she's very well respected. She's thought of as a very smart judge, and she's also thought of as a rather independent thinker. I mean, I think it's better for the government to have a smart judge than someone who's not, just because, you know, I think if you analyze this closely, you can sort of see the competitive injuries that are likely to emerge. But she's an independent thinker. We've seen that already in how she's, basically went with the, she refused the government's request for a March trial date, went almost all the way back to the date that the defendants were seeking. She refused the government request on the first day of the government shutdown to stay the case, which the government in all civil cases made this effort everywhere around the country, and she said no. I mean, she's shown herself in the past in unrelated cases, in national security cases, to be sort of an independent figure, not overly deferential to the government. So, you know, the fact that she's not overly deferential to the government, obviously has got to concern the government a little bit. But I think, again, she doesn't have much of a track record in antitrust. I'm not sure how much someone can extract from the Microsoft case, because it was a Sherman Act Section 2 monopolization case, not a merger case. Other than the fact that she's, from that experience of a dozen years ago, and she supervised the settlement for many years thereafter, it's obviously, she has some familiarity with antitrust doctrine. So, but I think she's a very good judge. She has a very good reputation, and so we'll have to see.
All right. So that's your view, kind of on the defendant's side. But let me throw out another argument they're putting out there, which is, and you brought it up briefly, which is this merger is going to be very good for competition.
Right.
It's going to actually bring prices down. There's going to be efficiencies. There's going to be benefits. There's going to be more flights, more destinations, more custom for more people. You know, why haven't we spoken about that as being a risk that the party?
Well, why haven't we spoken about it being a risk? I mean, I guess it is a risk. Maybe it's because I don't think very highly of those arguments. And so, but I think you have to, if you're going to assess this, you have to examine those arguments. So, you know, do we need this merger? I mean, the first level of that argument is, do we need this merger to take on this, you know, now United post-merger with Continental and Delta post-merger with Northwest, sort of what they would describe as two behemoths in the airline industry, and we need a strong third player. First of all, my assessment of that is we really don't. I mean, you can't. I remember it wasn't too long ago that American Airlines, it probably was 5 years ago, I'm not exactly sure when, was the largest airline in the world. They were sort of a behemoth, clearly. And they had their problems. They went into bankruptcy. They're still, in terms of their route structure, in terms of the number of passengers flown, they're still a very strong airline. I don't think they need any help from U.S. Airways in order to compete with United and Delta. It just seems silly to me. And, you know, and now, in the most recent quarter, they had a record level of revenues and very high profits. They're clearly emerging out of bankruptcy, when they do emerge out, as a very healthy airline. Even U.S. Airways, it doesn't have much of a international route structure. It does have some, especially to the Caribbean and some places in Europe, but it doesn't have that much. But in the United States, particularly the eastern half of the United States, it's a very strong competitor. So, and in fact, dominant in many markets, you know, in sort of the Northeast and some places in the Southeast. I just don't accept the theory that you need to create, these airlines can't compete with United and Delta. I mean, this is, I think, a very different market. You know, one area where we sort of, with the cell phone market, where we have sort of these AT&T and Verizon, and the concern that we need strong competitors, AT&T and Verizon. One of the reasons we need that is because AT&T and Verizon have about 80% of the sub 1 gigahertz spectrum, which for those of you who aren't don't follow telecom, sorry to use that sort of jargon, but, you know, sub 1 gigahertz spectrum is the best spectrum. And so we have a sort of a resource, sort of a government-granted resource, which is in short supply. And we would be concerned if we allowed, you know, this is one of the concerns that came out of the proposed AT&T-T-Mobile merger, is that would make AT&T much stronger and Verizon still strong. We'd have this duopoly of two large cell phone carriers, with people who wouldn't have access to the spectrum in order to compete. We don't have any sort of government resource in this thing. There's nothing to stop any of these airlines from getting more airplanes. There is four slot-controlled airports, only one really implicated, DC Reagan National. Other than those four slot-controlled airports, airlines are free to get gates at airports. So there's no sort of artificial restraint that says these airlines can't grow to compete with United and Delta. So I don't really buy that argument. I don't really think that's a serious argument. Certainly, that's what the defense lawyer said after this case was filed. So I don't really think this case is going to turn on that. On your point about, well, the new airline will have more, a larger network. It'll be better for consumers then. More places it flies to, U.S. Airways flyers will now be part of the American Airlines, you know, international network and their international frequent flyer, so it's better for people. I mean, I think that kind of logic would tell us that it's better to have one airline, because then we'd have, you know, the best possible connections and the seamless connections. I mean, now we're getting into an efficiencies argument.
Right.
So, the question with efficiencies is, are there identifiable efficiencies emerging from this market? The case law, as you folks have pointed out in some reports that you've done, says that you can only look at in-market efficiencies, that is, efficiencies related to the competitive injury. If you say that we defend this merger because the efficiencies will alleviate the competitive industry, this kind of competitive injury, rather, this kind of argument doesn't really relate to that. It's sort of out-of-market efficiencies. That forget about the thousand city pairs that we're talking about, that consumers all over the country will have access to better connections. And there's been a the PNC Bank Supreme Court decision, not PNC, it was Philadelphia National Bank Supreme Court decision, said that kind of, in the 60s, it's an old precedent, but said we don't consider efficiency like that. That's not a legally cognizable efficiency. So I don't think that sort of efficiency argument is convincing. We hear this with respect to every airline merger.
Right.
You know, one question you didn't ask me, which I want to answer, because it is, well, so why is this merger different than all other airline mergers we've seen in the last decade or so? That is, can I answer that my own question?
Absolutely. That was actually my next question, promise you.
Okay. So United Continental or Delta Northwest or Southwest AirTran? Well, I think those mergers were different. So a lot of people, and this is why I think your analysis was excellent, but a lot of people thinking about those mergers said, well, this one's likely to go through. Look, over the last 5-6 years longer, DOJ hasn't stood in the way of these mergers, and this is precedent for these mergers going through. I think that was actually precisely the wrong lesson. As each of these mergers occurred, it became more difficult to get the merger, each successive merger through, and this one most of all, simply because we have fewer competitors. So when we're talking about a 6-5 legacy merger like Delta Northwest, or a 5-4 legacy merger like United Continental, there's still, after the merger, 4 legacy competitors. And in the case of Delta Northwest, 5. I mean, much less competitive injury. We'd be talking about, you'd be examining the markets which went down to 5-4, generally not considered under antitrust standards enough to bring a case. But simply the fact that there's been so much consolidation made this merger harder to get through. And so I don't think it was that surprising. I mean, you can talk about, you know, Bill Baer is obviously a very vigorous antitrust enforcer. He's obviously, we're now 5 years into an administration different than the Bush administration, which considered Delta Northwest, although it was the Obama administration that considered United Continental. But you can talk about that. But I really think the real thing here isn't so much a change of enforcement philosophy. I think they did precisely the same analysis. It was simply that there's more concentration in the market. And I'll stop with this. Going back to AT&T Mobile, we saw the same thing in that merger, where there had been a whole number of mergers in the cell phone industry. There was Sprint Nextel. There was AT&T Singular. There were a number of mergers, and all those went through without much of a problem. Then we come down to the 4-3 merger, AT&T T-Mobile, and that one got blocked. So I don't really think that's that surprising, and I don't think they're using a different kind of analysis. I think it's the same analysis, just more concentration.
So I think that where you're going with this is a really good learning lesson for everybody on this call here, which is that there's a reason why many people look at these mergers and say, well, our competitors have their mergers, now it's our turn. You owe us one. The DOJ doesn't look at things that way. They never owe anybody a merger.
And they always look at the market as it is today, not the market as it was in 2008 when Delta and Northwest merged, or 2010 when United and Continental merged. It's the market in 2013. And so there's fewer number of competitors. Right. I mean, it's sort of unfortunate, I guess you'd say, except that we do have an antitrust law where we don't want excessive consolidation. So the later ones of the parties are the ones that sort of get left out.
This seems to be sort of a more of a political argument of fairness, right?
Yeah.
What role does politics play in the merger enforcement?
Now I'm going to sound sort of hopelessly naive, but I don't think, particularly in this one, politics had much of a role to play at all. I mean, most of the political imperative in this case would have been to let this merger go. We had letters written from a number of members of Congress saying that, we don't want to see U.S. Airways being forced to divest slots Reagan National because they serve our, you know, our towns in smaller cities. And the labor unions were all in favor of this merger because they had gotten certain guarantees of, you know, job protection coming out of the merger. And, you know, of course, the Obama administration, the Democratic administration is sympathetic to labor. So you'd think if it was political considerations calling the shots, they would have let it go. I think, by and large, in most cases, the antitrust analysis is fairly immune from this stuff, especially at the Justice Department. Now, I think there was one significant political factor, which I think was missed by most analysts here, was first of all, there was a very good hearing at the Senate Antitrust Subcommittee in my alma mater in February or March. But second of all, I think more important than that, was the letter, an excellent letter, Senator Klobuchar sent, the new chairman of the Antitrust Subcommittee, with Senator Lee, who's obviously no liberal Mike Lee, which didn't call on the merger to be blocked, but raised some serious concerns, including significantly, I think, this ancillary fee concern. And I think that should have been a signal to people that the sort of the serious, respected people in antitrust, in the political side, the people that, if any of the Justice Department was going to look to anybody, would look to those people, had some concerns. I mean, I think that's the kind of analysis that's the role of politics in merger review. It was, at least I like to think it was the case when I worked in the Senate, and it wasn't so much the member from the home state of a, you know, as a constituent was worried about protecting service into the airport or something. That kind of thing is different. But, you know, the head of the oversight committee who did a careful analysis of it, that kind of thing is given heed to. At least it provided political cover for Bill Baer to do what he did here. But in putting that aside, I don't think really politics played much of a role at this at all. And likewise, you know, since then we had an event about a month ago at the Capitol where a bunch of unions got together and rallied in favor of the merger. And, you know, what's the effect of that? I don't think there's any effect of that. I mean, now this case is, DOJ is going to prosecute this case unless it can find a true settlement that solves competitive problems, which I don't think is very likely. And it's going to really be up to a federal judge who's not going to be influenced by that. But in a merger like this, I just don't think politics had much of a say in it.
Okay, but you know, you do see them settling with, for example, the AG of Texas.
Right.
You know, what's going to stop the same thing from happening in the other states?
And then it very may well. But I think that's unimportant. I mean, this case is being fought out by the Justice Department about national concerns. Whether or not, I don't want to denigrate the great state of Texas or any other of these states, but whether or not, you know, the Attorney General of Texas or Michigan or any other state is part of it really isn't the thing that's going to say who wins or loses. So, you know, it's very predictable what happened in Texas. The state attorney general was able to get some very nice concessions. You know, the headquarters is going to stay in Dallas, which I think they'd already said it was, but they got the concession. There's going to be service for a period of time to the smaller cities in Texas. That's great for him. It doesn't address the national competition issues that the Justice Department's complaint talks about, you know, except for maybe, I don't know, one or two markets. It's not going to address, maybe none. It's not going to address any of those 1,000 markets that DOJ identified. It's not going to address ancillary fees. It doesn't address what's the likely effect on price and service after this merger. So that's Texas, but any other settlement in any state like that, again, wouldn't matter much.
Okay. We're about to turn over to some of the questions we have from the audience here. You know, I encourage everybody who's out there listening on this call, you know, certainly you hear Seth's predictions about being a very small chance of a settlement, a very small chance of the government winning a trial.
You said small chance.
Of the parties, thank you, of the airlines winning a trial. You think the government's more likely to win the trial. Certainly not everybody, not necessarily everybody on this call who's listening in may agree with that. I invite you to try to vet any arguments why you think this might, you know, where you think the holes in are, where we're seeing this. As those questions come in, I'd like to, all right, here's one question we got. So after this merger is over, what do we think about the airlines industry and what's it going to look like? If this case is blocked, you know.
Well, I mean, I think what will it look like? First of all, I think American will emerge from bankruptcy independently. They had a plan to do this before U.S. Airways approached them. I guess January of 2012. You know, what will it look like? at least you'll have four legacy competitors. I don't think it'll frankly look very different than it looks like today. I just don't think it'll be much worse. I mean, there will be continued to be entry sort of on a small scale. I mean, the kind of entry we see is like flying between New York and L.A. or Washington and L.A. on a Virgin America, that kind of entry. We don't see very much entry into smaller cities, smaller airports, and I don't think that's going to change very much. What will it look like? I think it'll be similar to the structure of the industry today, with the exception of that American will be out of bankruptcy.
Do we think we're going to see more bankruptcies?
It's possible. A fuel prices spike, although with respect to the legacy carriers, now they've pretty much all gone through it. So there isn't much room, unless they have another collapse in the marketplace, for them to go through it anymore. Another question is, will we see more consolidation? And that's possible, too. The kind of consolidation that would work is sort of a smaller carrier getting, like two smaller carriers combining. Frontier combining with Allegiant or something. I'm just speculating. I have no knowledge of any of these deals. But some smaller deal. Or maybe one of the large carriers picking off a smaller one. I think if this deal is successfully blocked, we will not see, just as we don't see in the cell phone industry to date anymore, we won't see any more consolidation among the big four, of the four legacy carriers. That'll sort of put a stop to that.
Okay, and if the merger does go through, let's say the rare chance these parties win, where do you think it's going?
The merger goes through? Well, that's interesting. Because the argument of the airlines is if the merger goes through, to the extent there's sort of a super competitive level of concentration, there's going to be new entry. So the airlines would tell you, if the merger goes through, where you see high concentration, there'll be new entry by new carriers. I'm not sure I believe that. I mean, think of it as, and this is getting us back to sort of what we talked about before, I think another important thing to think about this, and I think will be important at trial, is what's happened after United Continental and what's happened after Delta Northwest. And, the Wall Street Journal actually did a series of, maybe somewhat surprisingly, because on their editorial board they certainly don't support this case, but their news operation is independent. Anyway, they did a series of articles before the government filed its case, and including the morning of the government filing its case, before they knew, showing what had happened at hub airports where United hub airports and Delta hub airports after Delta Northwest. And with a few exceptions, capacity was reduced and fares increased. And I would think you would see that here too. I think I take very seriously what Doug Parker said in statements about consolidation. I think we'll see higher fares, we'll see capacity reduced, we'll see higher ancillary fares. Now, that may create an opportunity for low-cost carriers to come in and sort of combat that. But I think that's the reason I think that's important for trial is that's certainly evidence the government is going to use in making predictions about what's likely to come out of this merger.
All right, and Teddy, you had a question.
Yeah, you guys have both done a lot of calls with a wide range of stakeholders on this merger. Where do you the consensus seems to be very bullish that the deal is going to go through and that the merging parties will win in court. Where do you think people are getting that wrong and why? From the discussions that you have.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the consensus has been bullish from day one of this merger, and it's been wrong since day one of this merger. This merger was going to go through. No way Justice Department would challenge it. The only kind of concessions would be at Reagan National. That would take care of it. I don't want to denigrate anybody on this call, from Wall Street, but I think to a large extent Wall Street's gotten this wrong from the start, the investment community. Not everybody, of course, but there's been sort of that consensus has been wrong. What do I think they've gotten wrong? I think they've sort of been overly swayed by the results of past airline mergers. And I think also it's an overhang of the idea that the airline industry is sick and is losing money, and which was the case in the mid-2000s, certainly. But if you look at the statistics over the last year or so, it's been very healthy. So, but they, how can the government stand in the way of consolidation of this industry when it's been so sick? I mean, I think there's that sentiment out there. I guess that's my sense. I don't know, Joe, if you have any thoughts on that regard.
I agree with everything that Seth just said, but actually, to answer Teddy's question, I want to jump back to something Seth said much earlier on the call, which is sort of the chance that this thing can settle, or the chance that the government thinks that it could have a weak case and sort of bow out at any point. The government has had the discretion to bring all of these cases and has elected not to. It wouldn't have brought this case if it wasn't looking to do battle over this particular merger. And I think that all of the considerations that go into, you know, the health of the industry and the importance to what might come to benefit consumers as a result of the merger, that has already been filtered through their thought process and sort of discarded. So all of the things that would normally go into factoring into them agreeing to some sort of solution that doesn't really address the problems, and I also agree with Seth that there really isn't a structural divestiture here that can solve those problems. I just don't see it happening or being feasible. I just don't think they're going to shift in their approach and their way of looking at this deal at this point in the game.
No, I think that's very helpful. I think we have a question from the audience here.
Okay. So one question is, the parties are trying to frame this case in terms of passengers, not routes. They claim 85% of these passengers will have at least one other LCC to choose from. If they make the number of passengers affected appear even smaller, when do you see the efficiencies to the larger nation offset the impact to a small minority?
Okay, well, I sort of have several responses to that. First of all, the way the Justice Department has always analyzed airline mergers, and I think it's the only way you can, is you have to look at it route by route. You have to look at it as a city pair basis. You can't, and so you can't say, you know, it's better from passengers from New York to L.A., so we don't care if Charlotte to Miami, and I'm making that up as a route, is affected. So even if it's, and so I'm a little leery that 85% of the validity of that statistic, given the number of routes. Now, I know a lot of these cities and these cities pair are pretty small, but still, to say only 15%, 85% are unaffected, or 85% have alternatives. Now, I think maybe where that 85% comes from is that it's a disagreement with the analysis that it goes down from 4 to 3 or less, 3 to 2 or less, in these city pairs, and they're going to say, well, you haven't factored into, you know, flying out of Dulles Airport, you know, from Reagan instead of Reagan National, or flying into Love Field instead of DFW in Dallas. So that might be the basis of that. And actually, that is an important point that we hadn't talked about earlier. One way to attack the government's city pair analysis, or you know, reducing the number of competitors in those city pairs, is to say they haven't properly looked at nearby airports. And this is where economic evidence is going to be really important. I mean, I think we all know anecdotally, if we live in Washington, D.C., that we really don't like to fly out of Washington, Dulles. Or I think that people who live in New Jersey and fly out of Newark probably don't want to go out of JFK and cross over New York. But, you know, that's all anecdotal and supposition. They're going to have to do economic analysis looking at what actual consumer behavior is in these cities and how they're affected by price changes. So, you know, if prices went up 5 to 10% at Reagan National, would people then go to Dulles? So that might be a way, that's probably how they get to this 85%, to say that if you think about these other airports, there's other choices. So that's all it ultimately comes down to, has the government constructed these markets correctly, which is going to depend on the evidence introduced at trial.
Yeah, and I think that I'll build that off with another point that I kind of saw, which is, you know, framing in terms of passengers and not routes is exactly what I agree with the question. That is exactly how the parties are going to go. Look, this isn't 1,000 relevant markets and $6 billion of revenue is not uniformly distributed across these 1,000 routes. In fact, it's as you'd expect, very it's broken up. You know, a very small percentage of routes account for a very large percentage of the passengers, and when you when you do break it down that way, you do make the you kind of change the scale of the harm, and it's not $6 billion spread across 1,000 routes, but maybe $5 or $4 billion spread across a much lower, you know, 100 routes, and that is absolutely the attack that the parties are going to go. And I think that that's that really does speak to the overall point in the case, which is what is the ability of the Southwest and JetBlues of the world to disrupt those specific flights? Can you segment that off enough? Can you segment the flights and the commerce off enough that all of a sudden it looks a little bit more, it looks manageable enough, not just a little bit more manageable, because remember, these are, you know, you're still whittling down a lot of markets here and a lot of commerce. Is it whittled down to the extent that's necessary to really show that it's easy for JetBlues and Southwest and everybody else to jump on it? It's going to be done, and it can be done, but it's the extent to which is what's going to be challenging for the merging airlines. And Ted, you got one more?
Yeah, I've got one last question, and a little bit lighter note. Okay. You know, you're looking ahead to 2016.
Yeah.
If you have a Ted Cruz president or a Jeb Bush president, DOJ,
right.
Let's just assume the deal doesn't go through. Right. Do you think they would try it again?
Well, I put it this way. Well, first of all, I think that the chances of a Ted Cruz presidency are much less than the chances of the airlines winning this case. I mean, it's pretty small. But anyway, but a president like that, yes, they wouldn't bring a case like this. So sure, if it's a different political climate, you would expect, you know, we just have to see what where the economy is and what the markets are like at that time. But yeah, if it was a complete change of administration, especially in sort of a radical direction, not a, you know.
What about like a Jeb Bush?
Well, Jeb Bush, okay. Yeah, I mean, I think Jeb Bush is interesting. I couldn't make a prediction there. Obviously, you'd get sort of a mainstream Republican as heading the antitrust division. You know, someone like a Hugh Pate, people like that. You know, very well-respected people. Tom Barnett, figure like that. You know, and where would they make these calls? These are all very discretionary calls. You would think that it's less likely that that they would oppose this. However, if you remember the United, anybody remembers the United U.S. Airways merger in 2001, which actually bears some similarities to this attempted merger, especially the concentration at Reagan National, which was very high, and the overlaps in the East Coast of the United States. That case was brought to a challenge by the Bush administration, by the Charles James. And actually, they didn't actually file suit, because when they announced they were going to file suit, the parties abandoned it. But so these things don't absolutely follow lockstep, like Republicans wouldn't bring this case. And I think there's enough concentration Republicans would bring this case. Sort of a radical figure like a Ted Cruz is a different story. But a Jeb Bush, I don't know.
All right, well, that's all the time we have today. Again, Seth, thank you so much for participating. And again, if anybody out there would like a replay of this call, please just email us at editorial@thecapitalforum.com. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.